do me as well as for things like...
But I mean, in terms of setting up professorships and all this sort of thing. He did, he was really very open-handed about many of these things. And so
well, I think that is a good thing to say.
When he did a gesture, you know, it was a very meaningful thing.
Because there is a very strongly negative impression of him from the interviews.
Yeah, but you know, when he did something, he did it right. If he set up Hector's professorship, he put out $750,000, and then a couple of years, or then a few years later, think, maybe isn't that enough? Maybe we should make it a million, this sort of thing. So he'd stick in another $250,000. So he did it right. And there are a lot of things around the city, of course, that have benefited from his donations and from Evelyn's donations.
Yes.
And they did them very generously. Among other things, the Wisconsin Academy, of course, benefited from his will.
Well, okay. I just turned that on because this is those things otherwise. This is an interview with Robert Burris on May 31st, 1983, taking place in his office in the biochemistry department, and I'm Laura Smale.
I grew up in Brookings, South Dakota. I was born in Brookings and lived there for the first 22 years of my life. We lived one half block off the South Dakota State campus, so it had a pretty strong influence all through my boyhood. My dad was a job printer in Brookings, and for 7 years through high school and part of college, I worked as a printer in a job shop. So at that time, I was really fairly skilled in all arts, and this art has probably changed about as much as any in the intervening years. So nobody spends much time sticking type anymore by hand, but it's all changed very drastically. I went through Brookings High School and participated in quite a few activities there. And during my high school years, certainly I was interested in science, took math throughout the high school and all the science courses that were offered, biology, physics and such. There wasn't any chemistry offered in the high school at that time, but I took what science was offered. And I read a number of books on science and felt that I was very interested in getting into chemistry. So it was fairly early in high school I decided I should get into chemistry.
Do you think it was a teacher, or were you
at it? There wasn't any chemistry course in the school.
Right.
We had a good physics teacher, but that didn't come until the senior year. They had a miserable biology teacher. They'd taken from the typing course and had her teaching biology. She was really quite ignorant, so this was not an influence toward science. But we had also in physics, we had a very good practice teacher. The college used to send teachers down, and Horrigan was the physics teacher, and then as a practice teacher was a fellow named Batson. Later I took bacteriology from him when he was on the staff, and he was a first-rate teacher. So there was some influence there. But I think it was generally a matter of reading and such, and just general interest in science. There was no background in science in the family. My father was a printer, and his father had been a farmer. Incidentally, he had come from Wisconsin when it got too crowded about 1880, went out South Dakota and homesteaded about 25 miles west of Brookings. And my mother's father also had come from Germany, but he'd lived in Wisconsin. He'd come at about age 9, and he had left Wisconsin and had homesteaded in South Dakota about 20 miles northeast of Brookings. So they both were from pioneer families. And my dad was born in a sod hut, actually, out there. On December 31st, if you can imagine being born in a sod hut in the middle of South Dakota. On December 31st. I think it was poor mother with the dirt floors and such and the sod hut walls, but anyway. So there was no science background in the family, obviously. I had one brother. He actually majored at, he was a couple years older, and he majored in journalism at college there, and subsequently was in radio work the rest of his life. In college, I took mathematics throughout and took chemistry, physics, biology, bacteriology from Herb Batson, a fellow I'd mentioned who'd been a practice teacher down in high school. And so I had zoology, botany, could have pretty good background in the sciences. But the major was in chemistry, so I took that throughout the college career. And there was very little research interest at a school of that nature. But there were some good teachers. Dunbar taught organic, and Binawees taught organic. And then probably the outstanding teacher was Lester Guss, who taught physical chemistry. And Van Potter and I took physical chemistry from Lester Guss together. And Van was there for the first two semesters, and then he came down here for the spring, what was our spring quarter, and he started the second semester at Wisconsin. So he finished his physical chemistry here at Wisconsin, and I must say he was quite disappointed in the physical chem relative to the teaching that he'd gotten from Lester Guss.
Oh, was that Matthews?
Yeah, it was Matthews. Yeah, it was Matty. So he'd expected great things from Wisconsin, but it didn't come in physical chemistry. But Guss, although he wasn't a research man, was really an excellent teacher. And in the last year, I took organic from him, and that was terrible. He was a physical chemist, but they made him teach organic, which was not his business, but physically he was very good. So that was one of the courses Van and I took together, and we also took German together. And Van at that time was doing graduate work, and I was an undergrad. I was a junior when I took physical chem. So the chemistry courses were well taught, but the staff was not really interested in research. They were pretty busy teaching. However, the experiment station chemistry laboratory was located in the chemistry building in the basement, and the director of the group was Kurt Walter Franke. And Franke had taken his undergraduate work at University of Virginia, and then had been with Gortner for his PhD at the University of Minnesota.
Oh, good.
So he was a strong advocate of Minnesota for advanced work. He used to spot the students in chemistry and offer them jobs working at the experiment station laboratory. And the notable thing that Franke did as a researcher was to demonstrate the toxicity of selenium. There had been two diseases in South Dakota and Nebraska, which were known as alkali disease and blind staggers. Now, alkali disease was a chronic selenium poisoning, and blind staggers was an acute selenium poisoning. It had been described in the cavalry horses way back in the late 1800s at the stations in South Dakota, but there was no indication of what the basis of it was. And then later it showed up in cattle, and there were other typical symptoms of it. This came from eating the general forage in the South Dakota and Nebraska and Wyoming areas where the soils had originated from pure shale, and the pure shale native rock was fairly high in selenium. So the common plants might have something like 30 parts per million selenium, and if they ate it over a prolonged period, they got toxicity. Selenium is a bit more toxic than arsenic. It's very similar to arsenic in its properties, but it's a bit more toxic. And then the disease blind staggers came from an acute selenium toxicity, which occurred when the cattle ate what were known as converter plants. There were a few plants, such as Astragalus bisulcatus and such, that concentrated.
Excuse me.
the the blind staggers came from eating these converter plants, which would take the selenium and concentrate it in the plants up to maybe 2,000-3,000 parts per million. So they ate these for a short time. The cattle were killed by the disease. In any case, Frankie established that selenium was a toxic agent and did rather extensive experiments in animals. So there was an animal colony that was worked on, and then there were selenium analyses to be done, and a wide variety of other analytical processes that the students helped with in the laboratory. My particular job when I was working down there was to develop a method for selenium analysis, and this involved digestion of the plant material, reduction of the selenium to metallic selenium, and filtration of it out on a pad of barium sulfate, and then colorimetric comparison against standards. It was not a particularly pleasant digestion and distillation. The digestion was like a Kaldol digestion with sulfuric acid. The distillation was with hydrobromic acid outside a hood plus bromine to volatilize it. And someone was working in bromine fumes. And then the reduction was with sulfur dioxide, which is also very toxic and irritating. So, but it gave reasonable results. And my first publication was with Frankie in 1935 on a method for analysis of selenium. Well, this was the background, and Van Potter and Al Moxon and Ed Painter were students who'd worked down there before, and Ed Painter had gone to Minnesota for his graduate work. And in early 1935, Van Potter had come to the University of Wisconsin to work with conioleum. It was the end of my junior year in the summer when Van was down here, and he'd become a good friend of Wayne Umbright. And they lived together down the dorm, and Umbright was working in bacteriology with Perry Wilson. He was getting a little tired of running endless Kaldol analyses and such, and so he suggested to Van it'd be nice to have somebody to run these, and Van said, well, why don't you get some undergrad to run them, and Wayne didn't know anybody in particular, and so Van suggested that maybe I'd be a good candidate. So I came out here in the summer of 35 and did routine analysis in Perry Wilson's laboratory in bacteriology, primarily under the direction of Wayne Umbright. And so I was introduced to Wisconsin at that point. And at the end of the summer, Perry Wilson suggested that if I'd like to come back after I finished my bachelor's, that he'd give me an assistantship in BACTI.
Had you expected to go into graduate work?
Well, I think so, but I don't think the plans were very well formulated. I didn't really have any specific place in mind to go, although I'd been interested in graduate work. It really wasn't that clearly formulated.
But you mean you might have gone into a commercial firm?
Or I might have started taking graduate work at South Dakota or something like that. It's a possibility. They didn't offer a PhD there, but they did offer a master's degree. So I might have gone into something like that, continued at the experiment station lab or something like that. But it really wasn't very well formulated. So this was an entree, and Madison obviously was a very pleasant place in the summer. I lived down in the dorms, as did Umbright and Van Potter. Trip Adams group on the lake, yeah. 35 was an unusually hot summer, so the dorms got pretty warm. But in any case, I went back to South Dakota State, finished up my bachelor's degree there, and graduated in June of 36, and then came down to Wisconsin for the summer and started graduate work here in Perry Wilson's laboratory in bacteriology. I'd had a course in bacteriology, but of course I'd had a lot more chemistry than I had bacteriology. So as a graduate student, I majored in bacteriology, and my minor was in biochemistry here in Wisconsin.
Did Did you have any questions in your mind as to whether Perry Wilson was the person you wanted to work for, or did you, or?
Well, I'd worked there in the summer, and you know, these were not very prosperous times, 1935, 1936, and so the jobs were few and far between. If people think that the Depression ended in 33 when Roosevelt came in, they're crazy. It didn't really end until World War II. Times were really pretty tough up until the war boom. And so in 35, 36, you didn't really have many opportunities. Mm-hmm. And so $50 a month as a research assistant looked pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually almost lived that first year on $600. It was, I think I spent $660 or something like that. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the grad students didn't live very in very plush circumstances, but we got along okay. And so there really weren't a lot of opportunities. There were just jobs were difficult to find at that time. And you see, the Work Progress Administration was still going full blast. We had, in the laboratory, in Perry's lab, we had three WPA men working in the lab. And the WPA fellows were up on the hill shoveling and this sort of thing. So there was a lot of work still going on in that period. So an opportunity to do grad work was really quite attractive.
Perry Wilson had a Rockefeller grant.
Perry didn't have Rockefeller that early. At that time, he had a Frasch Foundation grant. Herman Frasch, F-R-A-S-C-H. Herman Frasch invented the process for recovering sulfur from underground by piping superheated steam down to melt the sulfur so that it could be pumped to the surface. So this revolutionized mining of sulfur, and the Frasch process had brought in substantial funds, and Frasch had given the American Chemical Society a grant, and from this the ACS, American Chemical Society, gave grants, and Perry Wilson had a Frasch Foundation grant. So he was the envy of everybody else in bacteriology because he had something like $10,000 a year, and so he was in the driver's seat relative to everybody else who were living on a pittance as far as research funds. I don't think people appreciate now how hard it was to get the research funds at that time. Now people feel abused if they don't get $100,000 a year from the NIH. Back in those years, as I said, Perry was the envy of everybody around because he had $10,000. And this was money that could be used directly in any research he wanted to, really, in the area of nitrogen fixation. So he was in pretty good shape compared to the rest of them. But I'd worked in the laboratory with, of course, in Perry's laboratory in the summer of 35, and so I knew him, and so there were no problems.
Could you describe him, what he was like as a person, as a teacher?
Well, Perry was a very active person, and he was... He was really a very nice person to work with. He had ideas. He was really an excellent scientist. He understood proper controls, proper experimental design, and so his laboratory was really a very, I would say, the most active one in the department in terms of producing research results. He had a good group, and it was well run. And at that period, he was turning out some very interesting research. So it was an exciting era in his laboratory. And there were good students; they were attracted to Perry's lab. And it was sort of a nice lab to work in too, because it was isolated from the rest of the people. Now, sometimes this is disadvantageous. It wasn't that we didn't interact with the other students, we did, but Perry's office was in Ag Hall, where all the rest of the faculty was. But our laboratory was out in Old King Hall, and this is the old building next to the soils. King was a soil physicist here on campus way back when. And King Hall is a very old building there. And then the soils building was built to the west of King Hall. King Hall is still standing up there, barely. But on the south side of King Hall was a range of greenhouses. And a lot of Perry Wilson's work was concerned with leguminous plants, so he had to have greenhouses. And he had a couple of greenhouses there directly attached to the laboratory. which was very convenient. Mm-hmm. And then there was a head house on the greenhouse with autoclaves and that sort of thing. So, although it was a broken down building with wood floors and dirt underneath the floor and all this sort of thing, it was adequate, and it was well equipped in comparison to most of the other laboratories. And it was isolated enough so you could work without interruption, but you were right next to Egg Hall, so you could go to the library there, and you saw the people regularly over at Egg Hall, so it wasn't really too isolated. All the other people in the building were entomologists. Entomology was in the building. We were the only people other than entomologists in the building. And then the soils people were in what was known as the New Soils Building, which is now about 40 years old. Yeah. So anyway, it was a convenient place to work. And our greenhouse facility is right there with the laboratory.
So he had better facilities than Fred then, and Peterson.
Well, you see, at that era, I'm no position to judge because Fred was not really very active in research at that time. I took Fred's course in soil microbiology, I guess maybe the last time it was given, but Fred was already in administration, mm-hmm. and so his research program had tapered off. And I.L. Baldwin was moving a little more into administration at that point. Now Peterson's facilities were split. Mark Johnson at that time was up in Bakhti, so part of Peterson and Johnson's show was up in Bakhti, and part was down in Biochem, but that we see was in 36, and the wing on Biochem wasn't built here until 39, and so at that time Biochem was all confined to the 1912 building, which was really very crowded at that time. Peterson shared an office with a couple of others here, so they were very crowded down here. So. Although by modern standards, the King Hall Laboratory may not have looked that great. It was really, well enough equipped so that we could do most of the sort of things that we wanted to without too much difficulty.
What was Fred like as a teacher?
Well, Fred was an interesting teacher, but he'd been at it such a long time that he tended to ramble a bit. He'd start on a subject, and then he would remember something, and he'd reminisce about many of the things that he knew about it. So it was an interesting course to sit in on. Perhaps it didn't cover quite as much factual territory as one might have planned, but nevertheless, it was an interesting course because E.B. was an interesting person and very widely experienced in this sort of thing. So it was an interesting course to listen to.
Was this rambling, scientific rambling?
Yeah, mm-hmm. It was scientific and reminiscence of things he'd run into and this sort of thing. So, no, it was interesting to listen to it. I think I took it probably, I think I took his soil microbiology in 1937, mm-hmm. probably. And I don't know whether he gave it again after that.
Was he a very bright man in science? I mean, is that...
Yeah, he was... it was a little hard to evaluate him, but because I never knew him in his science, per se. You see, he was an administrator at that time, and his science was pretty much behind him, but obviously he'd done a lot of innovative things in science and had been active in microbiology, fermentation, and in the legume work on nitrogen-fixing legumes and such. So he'd done a variety of really quite interesting things, and he'd had some good students. And he was a very highly respected person, you know, and widely respected. Mm. Even in the later years, you know, he was on the First National... He was vice chairman of the First National Science Foundation Board, National Science Board. And National Science Foundation was founded in 1950, and E.B. was on that first board, and I think was the vice chairman of the board initially. So he was a very highly respected person in science and in administration. Now I took, was in the spring of 37, I took I.L. Baldwin's bacterial physiology, and that was the outstanding course in the department. Mm. Baldwin was a very well-organized person. He was an excellent lecturer. And a tremendous amount of factual material came through a well-run laboratory. That was a first-rate course.
Mm.
And I took the other courses in the department. Elizabeth McCoy taught industrial microbiology.
Was she a good teacher?
Yeah, she was very good. She was a bacteriologist. I suppose I've never known anybody who knew bacteria like Elizabeth.
Hmm.
She was a fabulous bacteriologist.
Where does this put her in relation to Baldwin and Fred? I mean,
you mean the Fred Baldwin McCoy monograph and such, or what?
Well, I mean, if she, you say she was a marvelous bacteriologist, does this mean she was?
Well, she didn't have the prominence that Baldwin and McCoy, or Baldwin and Fred had, because of their administrative roles and all this sort of thing. But nobody surpassed her as far as the knowledge of bacteriology. She just had an amazingly broad spread of information, all kinds of areas. Now, she was really a remarkable person.
But is there some way in which she's, I mean, she doesn't stand, one hears her name all the time, but is somehow as an adjunct. And from the way you talk, she was...
Well, I don't know whether it's, she was a modest person. And so she didn't try to push herself forward, and she didn't have nearly the visibility that that Baldwin and Fred had. So it was, she just didn't have that kind of visibility. But if you were to ask anybody that had gone through the department up there, I think they'd all agree that she was really the bacteriologist.
Did she publish?
Oh yeah, she published quite a lot. She had quite a lot of students, and she had very broad interests, and really was very very active in the department. And she was also active on the university scene and on the local scene to a certain extent. Her family was from Madison. They had a farm out here with some property on Lake Monona. And so she lived out there in the old family farmhouse. And she willed the property to the Wisconsin Academy of Arts and Sciences, but unfortunately it got fouled up in the courts. And her brother, eventually there was some problem about it, and eventually her brother got it rather than the academy, the bulk of it. She was very interested. She had broad interests. She was an industrial microbiologist, highly respected, and she knew a lot about food microbiology, and she was quite active in limnology, studying on the bacteriology of the lakes and such. She was in on the early lake team around here, so she had unusually broad interests.
Did she give papers at national meetings?
Yes, but she was not a member of the prestigious societies and that sort of thing.
Why not?
I really can't tell you. I think it's just a matter of exposure and that sort of thing. But the closest parallel down here would be Marv Johnson.
I was wondering if
and
that
Marv,
would be
the you
same
see,
thing.
Was the same type of person, but he always hid his light under a bushel.
Yeah,
and,
that's what Van Potter said, too.
So in a sense, she was a little bit like Marv, really a fabulous microbiologist, but not as widely recognized, I think, as a number of the others.
Hmm. Did you take a course from him?
From
Johnson?
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, I took Marv's course. Well, Marv was he was the greatest. Yeah, well, they were parallel in a good many ways.
Well, I thought you were going to expand on that.
Well, Marv, he's the greatest staff member the biochemical department ever had.
Oh.
And
because of his personality and his
just his intellectual capacity. The guy was fabulous. And I'm not making any exceptions for any of the current or past staff members. He was the best. But
he wasn't really so very much in biochemistry, was he? Because he worked with Peterson and Fred, so he would have been...
No, he was very much in biochemistry.
Did he interact with people like Steenbach and Link? And
very negatively.
Both
with
of
Steenbach,
them?
Well, not so much with Link, but Steenbach and Marv were not that friendly.
I'm going to turn the tape, excuse me.
Yeah. But Marv had a fantastically broad knowledge of science. And the thing that characterized Johnson was that he knew the fundamentals. It wasn't necessary for him to go to the book and find the data. He usually had enough fundamental information so he could figure it out. And among other things, he was very good in electronics. And he wouldn't think of copying anybody's circuit for an electronic gadget. That wasn't legitimate. You had to figure it out from scratch. And then you had to figure, how can I make this the simplest possible to do the job? The simplest one would give you the less trouble in the long run. So it was sort of a game with Marv, and he devised all kinds of fancy little simple electronic mm-hmm. gadgets. And he used the same approach in his teaching. Marv felt that if you're going to have a laboratory course, that you ought to understand what's going on. And so he would devise these ingenious experiments, which in the simplest possible way would illustrate the point. And then he'd build some kind of an electronic gadget, maybe to help out in the experiment. Now, the modern tendency is that you can't teach a course in biochemistry unless you get the fanciest modern scintillation counter with a microcircuit on it and a bunch of buttons. And the student goes in, he sticks a sample in, and he punches a few buttons, and the answer comes out. And he learns absolutely nothing about it. This would drive Marv up the wall. But there's a very strong tendency to think that the only way you can teach students is to teach them with the most modern gadgetry. And 9 times out of 10, all this does is obscure the point of the experiment. And as I said, this is exactly the opposite of Johnson's idea how to teach. I think he was right.
Has this influenced your teaching?
Well, I would think so, yeah. I would say that at the university, the best laboratory courses I ever took were Marv Johnson's courses on fermentation. The courses were well-designed, you ran the experiments were meaningful, and when you got done, you knew the point of the experiment. And so he ran a marvelous laboratory. And he continued to do this, and in subsequent years he developed methods as chromatography was developing. He developed laboratory experiments in chromatography, which were really, I thought, ideal teaching devices.
But have you tried to teach this way too?
Well, I tried to, yeah. I don't know, I wasn't as successful as Marv, but Bill Huckstra and I taught a course in laboratory course in plant biochemistry for a good many years. In spring of 37, I took Tottingham's course in plant biochemistry here. And that included a laboratory, which we had down in one of the old basement laboratories. And subsequently, I took over when Tottingham died suddenly in 1944, and from then on, I taught a course in plant biochemistry for probably 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then, maybe not 10 years, and then it came the era when I was, quite a bit of the course was devoted to teaching methodology and stable isotopes and radioisotopes. And not many people on campus were using isotopes at that time. And so there were a lot of people who took plant biochemistry just to get the laboratory experience in isotopes. And it seemed a little bit ridiculous to take plant biochem to get isotopes. So we established three courses in the department. One of them was in isotopes, and one was in chromatography, and one was in enzymology. These are one credit courses in laboratory. And Bill Huckster and I taught the radioisotopes and stable isotopes for some years. And so we tried to set it up, really quite a bit like Marv, with experiments in which they actually ran the experiments and used the instruments, and we tried to keep it as simple as possible. And this course was really quite successful. We had a limitation in apparatus. We had 12 Geiger counters, and we could accommodate 12 pairs or 24 students. And so we used to run four full sections, 96 students a semester in the isotopes course. So we were fairly busy. We were running four labs. Bill would take half of them, I'd take half of them, and then we'd give lectures in common on the methodology. So that went on for a good many years, and it was really quite a successful course, I'd say. Just testify that we'd fill it up, we'd turn them away, and when we got to 96, we'd turn them away semester after semester.
So this was it, but it was a conscious effort in your part to
yeah, I would
to
think
try
so.
And
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Follow his example.
Yeah.
Well, then how did Link and Steenbach? You must have taken courses, classrooms.
Well, Steenbach and Link never gave any laboratory courses, but Steenbach and Link participated in the general course. You see, when I was a grad student, there was a general course in biochemistry. I guess the number was 510. And that was a staff course. And it was taught by practically all the members of the staff. Mm-hmm. Link covered carbohydrates. Steenbach covered lipids and the fat-soluble vitamins. Tottingham covered plants. And Elvium covered enzymology. And I don't know whether, and Peterson covered proteins, and I don't really remember whether Paul Phillips and Marv Johnson lectured in there or not, but it exposed you to the to the staff, pretty much, and the lecturing was quite different in type.
So how did they compare? How would you rate them?
KP was the best lecturer. Link, I mean, he was a superb lecturer. KP may have had some faults, but it was not in lecturing. He took it very seriously, and he put on a marvelous show in his lectures. Really a great show. And lots of spontaneous things that he had very carefully thought out. I mean, he worked hard on these lectures, and they were masterpieces. So not only were they entertaining, but you learned a lot of carbohydrate chemistry, because he knew his stuff on this, and he presented it very effectively. Elvium's lectures were very good. They were very matter-of-fact, well-organized, not presented with a flair, but nevertheless, they were really very good. Excuse me.
All right.
The lectures from Steenbach were quite uninspiring. I would say uninspired and uninspiring. He covered lipids and fat-soluble vitamins, and my recollection was that about the only thing that one really felt was that you should memorize all the structures of the steroids and this sort of thing. And there was very little that got you very inspired about the area. I would say they were perhaps the poorest lectures in the group. Although close behind him was Tottingham.
Yeah.
Tottingham was the plant biochemist, and I was his successor And Tottingham normally was not a very good lecturer. Once in a while he'd get mad and give a good lecture, but by and large they were not particularly good. And the lectures that he gave, things on the Donnan equilibrium and this sort of thing, were really not anything that turned people on. Peterson's lectures on proteins were more dynamic than those of Steenbach and Tottingham. Pete was in no sense an inspired lecturer. He spoke in a sort of a bumbling fashion, I would say, with starts and stops and such. But at least Pete was rather enthusiastic about what he gave. And so they were satisfactory, although they were not as, certainly not with the flair that KP Link had, nor with the good organization that Elvium showed in it. But Pete's lectures were quite acceptable.
Did you ever feel that that Link was giving you misinformation or
no,
not thinking?
No, he taught. KP was covering carbohydrates in this course, and KP knew carbohydrates very well. KP was a showman, and so sometimes on a non-science topic, why KP would proceed to put on a show. And I imagine that his stories about the fellow coming in with a bucket of blood and such got better with the years and with the number of tellings and that sort of thing. But in terms of science, KP was not trying to lead you astray or anything. He was well informed in the areas in which he lectured. Now, as I mentioned when I was talking to you earlier, after KP came back from his bouts of TB, he never really got back into the swing of science so that he was really contemporary. As a result, he was somewhat defensive there, and there were many areas of science that he was not very enthusiastic about discussing. But when KP lectured, it was well prepared, and it was accurate. I don't think there was any question about that. He was a good scientist. So it was the course at least introduced you to most of the staff, although it was spotty in its content. In later years, the course was taken over by S. Snell, who gave all of the lectures, and then it was much better integrated because he knew obviously what had gone on before. But in this day and age, it's very difficult to cover the whole breadth of biochemistry authoritatively, and so we still, in our basic courses, do use not the whole staff by any means, but we use maybe four staff members would give the basic course so that they can. Four to six might give the basic course so that they can operate more in their specialties where they have more detailed information. Basically, the biochem course was satisfactory, but it was spotty in its coverage. The thing I think people fail to realize is how much progress has been made since that time. I took Tottingham's plant biochemistry course. What was known about photosynthesis at that time was appallingly little. I mean, they knew the structure of chlorophyll, and details on photosynthesis beyond that were just almost a complete blank. And virtually all the developments in photosynthesis, the detail of process, have come since 1940. Other than the structure of chlorophylls and that sort of thing, which were defined, but the other information on photosynthesis is just one big blank. And so how one could lecture definitively in photosynthesis at that time was very difficult. The intermediary metabolism, the photochemistry, the process and such, very primitive information. Yeah, well, I've worked some in photosynthesis, but not too seriously. My contributions there are minor, but I've always lectured in photosynthesis. Obviously, this is the central process that keeps the world going, and so I normally devote maybe 15 lectures a year to it in plant biochemistry. And that is in no sense comprehensive in photosynthesis, but at least it's a start on it. But it was just appallingly little known about it at that time. So they lectured on what they knew. Now some of the other areas like carbohydrate chemistry, in which K.P. Link lectured, there was a lot of organic chemistry known about the carbohydrates. Fair amount about the proteins and a good bit about the lipids. In all of these areas, obviously, there's been an explosion of knowledge, but at least there was pretty good basic information there. In photosynthesis, was very lacking in detail.
It's been said that that Marv Johnson, working with Peterson and Fred, spent much too long on fermentation. That is, that he might have, that if he had moved along into something of his own, I'm not sure what the implication is, but maybe you could comment on that.
Well, Marv could have cut the mustard in any area. He had a very good background in physics, which is not characteristic of all biochemists. But he had a lot of background in physics and good friends. Rollison from physics was one of his better friends. As a matter of fact, they grew up together up in Superior, Wisconsin. Got into trouble as kids together and this sort of thing. So he and Raleigh were rather close, so he kept close touch with physical developments. He was a good bacteriologist, a good biochemist. He had an extremely quick mind and retentive, and as I said, he knew the basics in all of these fields. And so he could start out from scratch and develop an argument that would hold water. The thing that was characteristic about Marv was that, as I said before, he really hid his light under a bushel. He had a fantastic number of ideas which he threw out freely, and you'd try to give him credit for these. He didn't want credit for them. If he took credit for them and got involved in something, then he had to slow down and do that instead of just thinking up something new. So. He was a constant source of ideas from which he did not seek, nor did he get very much credit. But most of the people were very appreciative of him. You know, Marv was tended to be a little bit brusque, and some people didn't like him that well. And some people tend to dislike people who are smarter than they are. And so there was a sort of resentment.
But how did it work out with him and Fred and Peterson? I mean, that team.
Marv was very much the junior member of the team, and he worked along with Fred and Peterson, and he was perfectly willing to work as long as he had an opportunity to get to the bench and do something with his own hands and this sort of thing. He really worked actively much of his career, and if he didn't have a chance to work in directly in the biochem lab, he'd be developing some kind of a gadget. Electronic gadget or something like that, something to keep us busy, because he had a constant stream of ideas in a wide variety of areas. I remember one time somebody talking something about divorce. Marv immediately pulled up the divorce laws from Arizona. Now, why Marv Johnson would know the divorce laws from Arizona is completely beyond me, because he lived with Hilda all his life, but he knew the divorce laws in Arizona. Well, that was characteristic. I mean, it was absolutely effortless for him, apparently. He just retained all this sort of information, and he could pull it up at the drop of a hand. So he was constantly putting out these ideas, and he was usually right. Occasionally he was wrong, but not very often. If I found myself differing with Marv, I always checked my data very carefully, because I figured I was probably wrong.
Did Peterson and Fred appreciate his ideas? Did they take advantage of them?
Oh, they didn't take advantage of him. They were very appreciative, but he wasn't, he never sought, you see,
well,
he never
no,
sought.
Well, I never took advantage of the ideas.
Oh, sure, there was no way you could avoid taking it. I got lots of ideas from Marv, you know. You couldn't go down and talk to Marv without getting an idea. And if somebody had a problem in a wide variety of areas in the department, they'd go talk to Marv, because they'd figure Marv would give them a few ideas. And they were always for free.
But Link not. Link not. He didn't.
Link was was not really an idea man in that sense at all. Link was a very well-organized scientist. He had an absolutely top-rate laboratory, well-developed, well-equipped, very neatly maintained, and the students were well-disciplined. They were productive up in KP's lab, and he followed through very logically on many of his studies in the carbohydrates and the dicumerals. He was a good organic chemist and a good biochemist. But he wasn't an idea man in the sense that Marv Johnson was. Nobody was.
Mm.
Marv had just an extremely broad background and a very quick mind, and he was able to put things together in a wide variety of disciplines. He could integrate these ideas and come up with solutions.
It's funny, I suddenly realize I don't know of anybody here who was a graduate student of his.
You knew, did you know Dave Perlman at over in pharmacy, was the dean of pharmacy, died about 2 years ago.
Know the name.
Dave Perlman was one of Marv and Pete's students here. You see, Pete and Marv's students were dispersed all over the country. Those people manned practically every pharmaceutical company in the country in their penicillin and fermentation divisions.
Uh-huh.
It's all passed by the board now. We don't turn out people like that. But during World War II, there was a big push on penicillin here. And Johnson and Peterson collaborated with the pharmaceutical industry. And the pharmaceutical industry collaborated internally, you see. Unlike the current things, Pfizer talked to Merck, and Merck talked to Roman Haas, and Roman Haas talked to Eli Lilly. And they all shared information on the developments in penicillin so that they could lick. This was a part of the war effort. So they all shared information, and Marv traveled quite a bit, and all the people in the pharmaceutical industry knew him. And he was highly respected by these people. But they had quite a lot of students, and right after World War II, fermentation was a very hot field, and there was a big demand, and it turned out students, and you would find Johnson's and Peterson's students in Pfizer, Lilly, Letterly, Upjohn, Roman Haas, Merck. You go down the list, and there were people in every one of those places, and sometimes several of them. So for a whole generation, they dominated the industry. Dave Perlman was at Merck for a good many years. He came back as dean of the pharmacy school here on campus. And so they had a tremendous influence there. And the people in the pharmaceutical industry recognized Marv as the sort of the fount of ideas, because he was quite active in the American Chemical Society Fermentation Division. As a matter of fact, the American Chemical Society Fermentation Division has a Marv Johnson Award that they give every year. Yeah. And where was it? On the plane, about a year ago, I ran into some fellow on the plane, and he wondered about what had happened to that genius from Wisconsin that used to come to the Fermentation Division meetings. And so this guy thought he was the greatest he'd ever run into.
I don't know, if these interviews have no other value, it seems to me they are reviving a reputation. You don't hear of him, at least I haven't read.
Well, he's a good example of a person, most unusual character, and very productive, but who didn't want his life complicated by administration or by getting involved in dozens of different things. So his impact on the
nation, presumably, he wasn't competitive, I would imagine.
Well, I wouldn't quite say that he wasn't competitive. He just he didn't want to be bothered by all this kind of stuff, you know. Bothered by administration, bothered by national organizations. He was active in the American Chemical Society and reasonably active in the American Society of Microbiology and that sort of thing.
Well, I meant not caring, not getting into a fit about whether his name was given prominence in it.
He couldn't care less.
That doesn't seem characteristic of most people. Did you know Harold Campbell?
Yeah,
was
sure.
He a fellow student?
He Campy was just a little after I was, I guess, but not. He was up in KP's lab. Mm. I can't remember exactly when Campy was here. It was pretty much the same time I was here. And, of course, he's been around over in McGarden for quite some years. You talked to Campy?
Yes.
And such him? Yeah, sure. I mean,
just wondering how what your assessment of him was as a student. I mean,
Campy was just one of the students from up in KP's lab. I didn't say that he was particularly prominent in anything around here.
Did any of the students stand out, or your fellow graduate students stand out?
Well, of course, Stan Moore was KP's student. He's a Nobel laureate. He died about a year ago. But he was on the Rockefeller staff at Rockefeller University for many years, Stan Moore.
Uh-huh.
Moore and Stein received the Nobel Prize together. Stein was a colleague at Rockefeller. So he was probably KP's most famous student.
Yeah.
Stan Moore. You mean students that were here at the time?
When you were there, one usually is aware of who were
Howie Snyder was quite outstanding. Howie also was on the Rockefeller University staff for many years. He's now retired. And
was he a Link student too?
Yeah. No. He was. Howie Snyder was a Steinbach student.
Oh.
So he was one of the outstanding ones, Steinbach, and he was one of the rare fellows who got along with Harry.
Mm.
Always did get along with Steinbach.
Because he stood up to him, or
yeah, he was sort of an unusual guy. He was a Milwaukee German, and very quick-minded, and he was always. He always could anticipate Harry. He was always jump ahead of him and anticipated him. So he got along fine because he knew what was coming. The guys were standing and wait for it to happen. But Howie was always a jump ahead of the game. He got along fine with Steinbach. Always did. He's a good writer and quite a scholarly guy. So he wasn't the most productive scientist at Rockefeller, but he was very good. And other students in that era, let's see. Probably the brightest student in the bunch was Dilworth Wayne Woolley,
who was one
of Peterson's students. Woolley came from Canada. He was a farm kid from Canada, and he looked like a high school kid. I actually had very serious diabetes, and while he was a student, he got a burn, and it took forever for it to heal, as was characteristic of a diabetic. When he finished here, he had an opportunity to either go into, I don't know, there was literally a Merck at a very good salary for the times, or go to Rockefeller, and he chose to go to Rockefeller University instead. And so he completed his career there. But within a few years, he went blind. And so he had to operate without any eyes. And after going blind, he married a girl named Janet McCarter, who used to be on the staff in Bakhti here. And Janet, being a scientist, used to read the journals to Wayne, and he called a photographic memory, but it was in this case it was an auditory memory.
Mm-hmm.
He could retain everything that came through. He was a marvelous, quick mind, and so he continued a very active research while he was blind. Directed the people and did some very notable research. He was in by the age of 26,
mm-hmm.
I think Woolley had been in on the discovery of nicotinic acid. You see, when finally Elvium finally got this out, he did it with a collaboration of Woolley, Madden, Strong, and Elvium were the four people on that. Madden was a grad student who was working on the thing.
It is, but Robert, isn't it? Not James.
James.
It's Robert Madden. Is that right?
I don't really remember.
He's been referred to as both, so
I don't really remember.
Never mind.
I don't really remember. there was Madden, and he was working with Connie, trying to isolate this stuff. But the fellow who was really the expert on the staff at isolations and such was Frank Strong. And so Frank got into the picture, and Woolley was working down in that same lab, and Woolley got into it. So there were the four guys who finally got it out and characterized it. And Woolley was also in on the alopecia factor, which was a factor for, that was a biotin response, loss of hair or something like that. And he was in, I think, on one or two other vitamins by the time he was about 26. He came here pretty young. And Pete put him on a project to isolate compounds from molds, which Woolley proceeded to do. And when I came here as a grad student in 36, I was assigned to isolate amino acids from rhizobia, characterizing the protein from rhizobia. And so I'd used to come down and talk to Woolley, and I'd ask him, well, now, how should I isolate this amino acid? And Woolley'd say, well, I'll tell you, you want to clean that thing up. There's a nice 1912 paper by Krebs in page 242 of Zeitschrift for Physiological Chemie. He says, go look, that, or there's a method of Neuberg. Neuberg has a precipitant there. That'll clean things up. He had this kind of a memory, you know, he just dragged it out effortlessly, and so I would say that Woolley, in my opinion, was the outstanding student down here at that time. He was really fabulous.
I'm going to turn.